Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, it is really great to have with me Alex Lee. Alex is a senior VC investor at the Development Bank of Wales, where he invests in early stage tech businesses that are in or plan to move to Wales. The DBW has multiple funds and startups and scale-ups can access different forms of financing suitable to their needs. Prior to joining the DBW, Alex had co-founded a software development company and e-commerce business, as well as having worked both in private equity for an investment bank and family office, as well as turnaround for a FTSE 250. He launched the Tippy Top podcast in October of 2021 to share knowledge around entrepreneurship, finance, startups, and business, all centered around the Zulu concept of Ubuntu, or humanity. A product of an entrepreneurial family, Alex's mission is to help the planet and as many entrepreneurs as possible to pay his fortune forward. Alex, it's really great to have you here with me today.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks, Arish. Great being here.
Amazing. Let's jump right into it. So I really like this concept of Ubuntu that you talk about as why you launched the Tippy Top pod and all the related content that you have around that. Can you talk me through that a little bit more, especially around the entrepreneurial landscape whilst you were growing up in South Africa?
Absolutely, love to. So in terms of the Tippy Top, actually, I formally launched the blog back in 2015 and did a lot of blogging and vlogging. And then the podcast obviously came, you know, podcasts have become more mainstream recently. And I was always looking for a niche and an angle before I actually went live. And that finally came together in October last year, as you know. Now, in terms of my background, you know, I've always been helping startups. I've been helping my mother as a small business entrepreneur, and my roots really go back very far in terms of entrepreneurship from a very young age. Now, you mentioned that the concept of Ubuntu, and I think it's becoming more increasingly well known around the world. And as you say, it's a Zulu concept, obviously born and bred in Africa, you know, obviously at the southern tip in South Africa is where I'm from. And essentially what the concept is all about is there's actually a really good picture, and basically you have a tribe of children all sitting in a circle with their feet together. It's quite a familiar image for those of you who know. It's about 20 odd children. And it's just saying that you're all one. And there's this concept of universal consciousness, and also that basically, how can one person sitting in that circle be unhappy and the rest be happy? And everyone says that it's impossible, because if you're watching someone else's pain and suffering, how can you have enjoyment? So it's about making sure that you're sharing the food, that you're looking after everyone. And that's very much the concept I like to embrace. And I think it's quite commonplace in more of the, you know, the developing economies. When I come to, you know, more developed economies, I feel like there's this assumption that everyone is fine. And, you know, if you turn someone down for a job, well, it doesn't matter, they'll find another one. That might be true. But the reality is that most people aren't fine. And it's a very, very tough world out there. And I think people, you know, struggle to even, and you know, we're sitting in a very privileged position, and I'm very cognizant of that. And hence my mission to pay it forward and pay it back to, you know, everyone that's helped me get here. But, you know, I was it 2020? I went on a fundraising mission to help someone who is a car guard in South Africa, where my mum drives down to the beach, and he's the person that looks after the cars. And she hadn't seen him for a few days, and there was lockdown and so forth. And when she did see him, she's like, "Hey, you're looking pretty thin." And he said, "Oh yeah, it's been a bit tough with this corona thing and lockdown, and you know, me and my family didn't have food for 3 days." And you're like, "What?" So, you know, went to a lot of my colleagues and friends and did a fundraiser. And, you know, we raised a thousand pounds. Let me get that right. Raised £1,000 and then, you know, just gifted that to him. And you can just imagine the smile on his face. You know, that's 20,000 rand in South Africa, which here might as well be £20,000 to anyone. It's that much money. And what he could do with that was go send it back to his family in, I think it's Burundi, and build up a farm and make his family self-sufficient and, you know, completely change the life. And for, you know, the people here, it was between 10 and 50 pounds, depending who were. So absolutely nothing. No one felt it. But, you know, that's the kind of impact you can have. And as I say, coming back to it, like, how can you go down to the beach and enjoy it when you know someone is starving? And yes, there's lots of starving mouths out there, and it's a big problem. And, you know, the people in power are the ones that maybe are duty bound to do it, but they're not doing it. And that's why I want to help, you know, not only give those entrepreneurs money if we can and be a channel, a conduit for it, but give them advice that they know how to deploy it. Anyway, long story short, as I say, there's a lot of work we can all do. We can always all do more.
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting on this podcast, we've had a number of people who come from pretty diverse backgrounds, and certainly some who've come from countries that are not, you know, developed. I've spent a lot of time in underdeveloped countries myself. And I think that concept of sharing and being together and lifting each other up is really important in those sort of economies and in those environments, because you, as you say, right, how can you be happy if those around you aren't? I think here in developed economies, certainly in the West, we've taken a much more, you know, I guess, individual libertarian maybe approach to everything. We've seen a lot of that over the last couple of years with COVID. I think it's wonderful to hear someone who works, you know, very closely within the entrepreneurial landscape, you know, as an investor, to talk about that concept of lifting others up, because I think it's very easy to get, you know, swept away with the millions that are being funded, you know, the slip of the tongue you had, millions being raised in capital to launch, you know, delivery businesses or, you know, 10-minute grocery delivery, which I seem to like to bag on. I think there's a number of VCs that will never come on this podcast, maybe because of that. But, you know, we're raising loads of money for businesses that are pretty kind of inconsequential in terms of kind of changing someone's lives. Yet there are, as you say, these people out there that absolutely need more. I think that's such a wonderful way to think about it. So let's talk about the work that you actually do with the Development Bank of Wales. I can often feel for anyone involved in the tech ecosystem in the UK that most of what's going on is really highly focused on and around London, right? So what sort of businesses are actually launching in Wales? And like, what do you think the country has a real advantage in that would help fast growth technology companies succeed?
So I think the landscape has changed a great deal in the past 2 years, definitely. I mean, there's an emergence of a lot of pre-seed funds. There's an emergence of a lot of people who do or used to do Series A with, say, 2 million checks. They've probably been pushed down to seed with the ever-expanding rounds. But now they've got like a thin sliver of a pre-seed 50K, almost like, let me buy some loyalty and invest that into a business. So there's a lot more liquidity at that bottom tier there. But they aren't leading rounds. They're just topping up rounds. Other than that, you're reliant on angels and often angel networks. But that's, again, maybe, you know, limited to a lot of people's networks and maybe a bit of an exclusive club. Yes, there's lots of money sloshing around, but only certain people can access it. So I think historically, you know, I used to see a lot of entrepreneurs running around London pitching, saying, I'm looking for my pre-seed round. And everyone said, that's nice. We invest from Series A onwards. And so who was funding that valley of death? Who was, you know, doing those early stages? No one. And to those entrepreneurs, I said, come over to Wales. We'll look after you, incubate you. Yes, you can, you know, have an office in London. You can go back to London, you know, while keeping your presence there. But it's that oh so crucial pre-seed check. And I think that's really the advantage of someone like the Development Bank of Wales, who does have the risk propensity to take on those investments. I always say, you know, it's really difficult to price the risk and accept the risk at those early stages, which is why most people don't do that, besides angels who, you know, looking for the tax benefits and hooray for EIS and SEIS, right? And I think there's this, you know, everyone's really concerned, maybe, you know, traditional investors, about preserving their track record. And that's why they don't want the risk. They're like, yeah, we'll look at it, but with 300K annually recurring revenue. And you're like, well, that's not really true, you know, pre-seed investing. You're not taking risk. You're not assessing the business on the fundamentals based on the value proposition. You're analyzing some metrics. But if you look at those metrics, those are lagging indicators, you know, true visionaries and you know, particularly the US VCs who are entrepreneurial, they can see the opportunity, see the market, and they invest ahead of it. And so, you know, what we're seeing, you know, what types of businesses come to Wales, well, the best kinds. And what do I mean by that is you're having, you know, we've got assets in crypto, in space manufacturing, and they are some of the best performing assets, I would say, in the country. And the value that we unlock by being in the pre-seed round is you get all the benefits of that uplift in value throughout the rounds. Yes, you can come in later once it's got traction, but in terms of your value creation plan as an investor, you know, you're really limiting your upside. And, you know, everyone talks about the VC model being, you know, one asset and company, if we can describe it like that, can pay back the whole fund. Now, how are you going to do that if you're paying over the odds a very high multiple, you know, 20 times annual recurring revenue when you're fighting it out at Series A? You're not going to make the returns. So anyway, it's a fabulous offering. And you think, you know, there should be, in my view, a Development Bank of England, you know, and, you know, luckily there's not. So people come over and I get better deal flow. Great. But it's just this fundamental, like, form of market failure, which is being fixed. And I think people are starting to pile in, but it's just this diamond in the rough and happy days.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think I have similar conversations with the guys at Scottish Enterprise. There's a couple of things that I think it's worth pulling on there. So first of all, obviously, yes, as you say, a lot of that space is being occupied by angels with the SCIS and the EIS tax benefits that they get from early stage investing. And that has, you know, that is obviously an incredible benefit to the ecosystem. And it really allows a lot of businesses to get off the ground. But A, you know, you need to have the network of angels or high net worths that you can approach. And most people, I would hazard a guess, do not have that network. In fact, you know, we spoke with Jenny Irvine from Raise Ventures out in Northern Ireland. And, you know, she was telling me as an example that, you know, the angel networks out there are just not, I wouldn't say they're uninterested in tech. They don't understand tech because they've come from much more traditional kind of business environments and, you know, whether that's law or accounting or you know, physical retail. And therefore, it's much harder to understand kind of the investment process when you're looking at early stage growth kind of businesses. So I agree, having an institutional investor such as the Development Bank of Wales that can step in, pick up some of that risk at the very early stage is a huge benefit, I think, for founders, especially where they don't have those networks. I think the second thing, and I'd love for you to kind of give us a bit more color on this as well, is that, you know, the bank also has multiple different types of financing, right? So across multiple stages, you know, is there an interplay, or do people, you know, do companies come to you at different stages for different things, or do you see them through the whole life cycle? Does it just depend on what they need and when they need it?
Yeah, I think, you know, we glorify the tech entrepreneurs, you know, that are becoming unicorns, but the reality is that's not most businesses. So if you just look at the portfolio at Development Bank of Wales, it's 2,500 investee companies. And of those, the tech component is maybe about 100. And, you know, all of these businesses, you know, some might qualify for bank, you know, traditional bank loans, some might not. But in terms of DBW's offering, it's manifold. It's micro loans, you know, up to 50K if you want to buy an oven for your restaurant. It's property, help to buy loans. And then in terms of our offering in the tech side, we also have buyout as well, but we can fund businesses from pre-seed, seed, series A, series B, you know, depending on how big it is. And you get some really big ones, 50 million, which might be pushing the envelope a bit, but we can do follow-on rounds, you know, up to say, you know, 8 or 10 follow-on rounds if there were that many before it came to exit. So it really is a one-stop funding shop, which is such a diverse offering. You know, not many, if I can call it, you know, the VC team specifically, or Tech Ventures team, are 16 people within 250. Now, usually you'll have that, but it's usually like a private equity house with a VC arm. But there's not many institutions that can provide all types of financing to all types of entrepreneurs. So it's, yeah, very refreshing.
I think that's hugely compelling. And the other thing I just wanted to pick up on was, you know, you mentioned that obviously, yes, you have the great, you know, the best businesses in the portfolio, but you mentioned that some of these businesses don't necessarily need to be established in Wales, or can have, you know, they need to have a presence, but don't necessarily need to be 100% located in Wales. Can you just kind of expand on that a little bit? Because I'm sure there are businesses based out of, you know, England and various kind of regions within England, not just London, you know, who may well think, well, okay, Wales would be a great place from a geographical perspective, potentially from a talent perspective, cost of living, et cetera, but, you know, the financing is a problem. How does it work for people that might want to consider doing a partial move? What does that look like typically?
Great question. And I'll add to that, pre-Brexit, Cardiff was voted best quality of life city in Europe. Now, you just think that's phenomenal. And I think, you know, Wales, yeah, I live in Surrey. And when I took the job, you know, I was like, okay, let's have a look. Let's check out this Wales thing. And it's fabulous, you know, and I still live where I am and commute. So it's really not that far. And when the roadworks are cleared up on the motorway, it's probably about 2 hours, you know, with a fair wind. If you can drive, and again, on train, also about 2 hours, not far away. And what I say to businesses is that, you know, you're probably going to end up, you know, not scaling in London. Let's assume you're in London because, you know, it's just that the costs are just prohibitive. And not saying that the salaries in Wales are that much less, but the infrastructure around it is a lot less. And the community is very supportive. It's certainly an elbows in culture versus elbows out. In terms of what DVW requires, it used to be a lot more bums on seats, you know, because why does it exist? To help kickstart the Welsh economy, much like you've had in Silicon Valley and Tel Aviv. You know, coal mining died a death, and they've seen entrepreneurialism as the you know, growth engine of the economy, which is fabulous. So the requirements are a lot more flexible. I think I always say to people, you know, if you're flexible and you're not just looking for money, there's a genuine reason why you want to establish yourself in Wales, and you can have suppliers, customers, employees, one or all of the above. There's various ways to cut it, and I think, you know, for us, it's you know, demonstrate, you know, economic upliftment to Wales, and then, yeah, we'd love to have a conversation at that point. Obviously, it's still very commercial. We want to invest in good businesses that grow, you know, businesses that can grow from, you know, 0 to 10 to 30 employees in 2 years' time, because that creates the most benefit to the economy. But the reason it does that is because they are commercially viable, excellent businesses that are going places. So it all works, one hand washes the other.
Yeah, it wouldn't make sense if you were just funding the growth without actually reaping any of the benefits down the track. No, I think that's really important for people to understand, because yeah, it's an option in, you know, in the range of arsenal of kind of financing arrangements that are out there for people to consider. So thank you for expanding on that.
If I can just quickly add to that, I always say to later stage VCs, I say, if it's too late stage for you, DBW could look at it. They could perhaps invest as the first institutional investor, get all the governance sorted, get the board formed, get the board packs going, get the initial hires, de-risk it, and then, you know, might be alongside angels initially on rounds 1, 2, 3, and then DBW invests with all the major UK VC firms, you know, Maven, Octopus, whomever it may be, on your later rounds. So you've got that really smooth transition and you can scale up. So it's quite a beautiful interplay.
Amazing. So you talked a little bit about entrepreneurship there, and I kind of want to go on a little bit of a different tack. And it's crazy how entrepreneurs just get an itch that they feel they need to scratch. For me, that was bootstrapping my own consultancy and then launching and raising capital for a tech venture of my own. And then also this podcast, and, you know, the hint is in the name, as it were. What have been those truly entrepreneurial moments in your life? And I'd really love to understand, what are the risks that you wish you had taken but didn't? And what was it that stopped you taking them in the first place?
These are very thought-provoking and tough questions. I think I had a little think, and they say, you know, entrepreneurship starts from a very young age. It's not something you just kind of switch into. Yes, that might happen, but it's more kind of like a way of the way you're brought up, or at least I think so. And for me, actually, one of my first entrepreneurial success stories was at school, and it's a bit of an odd one, but I built a matchbox tower. So about 300 matchboxes, all stacked up, all glued very nicely in the shape of a house, and basically went to market days, and I stood on one side of this board with these matchboxes, and my customers or clients would be like the other side, and then they were numbered, and they could say, right, I picked number 156, and then they could push out that box, and there was either a bit of money in there, or there was a token, and you could win one of the prizes behind me, like a big fluffy teddy or whatever it might be. And I used this matchbox tower every single market, you know, every market day every year. And then the 1 year at school, I was like, actually, I don't quite like this, because there's a whole market going on behind me. And yes, I'm making a bit of money, but I'm not enjoying the market. So then I thought, okay, so I hired two people, and you know, in Rand's terms, I gave them 30 Rand and 30 Rand. And for the day I made 200 Rand. So net profit, 140 Rand, which isn't worth very much money here. But anyway, at the time it was significant to me. The employees were over the moon because they had this money in pocket, and I got to enjoy my day. And I was like, now that is some entrepreneurialism. And actually, I won Entrepreneur of the Day for what that's worth, you know, small time, little school in South Africa. So that was my first story. And then in terms of coming out of university, graduated into this GFC, great financial crisis. All these jobs I was promised as a young engineer weren't there. They did come back, but that forced my hand into doing the software development company, which now really helps me be a very good investor, because I've been through the software development journey and actually built it with my own hands, tested it, dealt with the clients and, you know, all the problems that come with that. And then the other thing I did was launch this e-commerce business. Of course, I read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week, or actually I started the business, then read the book and thought this would be fabulous, and worked, you know, 10 hours a week for about 9 years to work out. That was a load of nonsense. And anyway, great business model, but you still have to work at it, and sold it actually to one of the employees in a mini management buyout, if you like. Anyway, and that taught me so much and about business, far more than business school did. And actually, you know, I was sitting in a lot of private equity interviews, just, you know, talking about the things I'd learned in that small little business. So I, you know, strongly encourage people to become entrepreneurs, because it teaches you skills that will be relevant throughout your life. In terms of the risks that I didn't take, I guess it would be, I've taken on a lot of career risk by changing from engineering to private equity and then to venture capital. And I had a very good, you know, smooth path planned out in engineering, and that would have been really easy, you know. But I thought, no, I don't like going to work in overalls. I don't like working odd hours on an oil rig or something like that. I like business. I like people. And this is what I'm going to do. So it's the closest thing I can do to entrepreneurship. And if I could say, what risks didn't I take? I guess it's not jumping in with 2 feet in being an entrepreneur, because I had this career, so there's this safety net. So, but I think in terms of what I've chosen, it's the closest thing I can get to entrepreneurship, and I get to work with entrepreneurs every day, which is fabulous, and lots of them. And I think if I were ever to, and one thing I guess I regret is not building something. And when I talk about building something, I'm talking about, say, podcast series or whatever it might be. And I spend a lot of time doing job applications with anyone in venture capital, private equity, unless you're one of the fortunate few, knows you have to apply for a lot of jobs, and maybe not just once in your life, again and again. So I can tell you a lot about job applications, but I'm not sure that that's actually a relevant skill. So I wish I had spent that time really, you know, engaging with those people I was speaking to and building a repository. And if I could finish, the time I will take a risk as an entrepreneur again is when I have an unfair advantage and I can see a massive market opportunity, because I've done the lifestyle businesses that didn't quite scale, they did okay, and I'm not going to waste my time. Next time I'm going to do it right, and hence why I'm doing the Tippy Top podcast, so that if I do want to do that, I can play back the episodes to myself and read the write-ups and do it right first time.
We're going to talk about that in a second. There's a few things that are definitely worth kind of digging into. So you were tokenizing. So back in the day, young Alex Lee, as a young lad in markets, was basically creating the foundations of Web3, it sounds like. So a tokenized game where people could basically either pull out a coin of their own or exchange it for an NFT, otherwise known as a fluffy toy. No, look, I think that's a wonderful story. And I think entrepreneurship, a lot of people I speak to and that I know certainly haven't had kind of that ability to do something whilst they were kind of in the younger or tenderer kind of ages. I remember sitting with my cousins in our garden. You know, we used to live about 8 or 9 of us together, and you know, we'd sort of be playing with sticks and stones, and we'd sort of set up this whole barter arrangement. And you know, you learn kind of, I think, a lot about those very, very basic skills of entrepreneurship by doing those things. And it's very unfortunate that I think, you know, and this is probably an entire podcast on its own, but it's very unfortunate that in schools we aren't taught more of that, or we don't teach more of that. The second thing that I think is really interesting, and this I don't think, you know, so I understand exactly what you're saying when you talk about, you know, you kind of went from the lifestyle business to now thinking, okay, the next entrepreneurial leap that you'll take would be into, you know, into a massive scalable business. But ultimately, I think it's really hard, because for for a lot of people, that lifestyle business is a massive leap in and of itself. You talked about having the safety net, a job. For many people, I think even setting up that e-com store and even, you know, getting it to £2,000-£4,000 or dollars a month in clear takings is a massive kind of unlock for a lot of people, because it just gives them the optionality to go out and do whatever else it is that they want to do. And equally, you know, for those of us that maybe have the inclination, the ability, the interest, and let's face it, also maybe a little bit of, I don't know, sadomasochism to get out there and try and build something truly, you know, truly immense, that's a really exciting journey. It's one that I chose to take like in my 40s, and you know, not there yet by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I'm very excited to see where it might go. I think it is really, really important though, as you say, to have that environment, that entrepreneurial environment around you. And if you don't have it around you, seek it out. Like if you can, if you have, you know, a friend whose father is a pharmacist, or, you know, someone who has been able to buy some properties or is renovating stuff or is going out and just taking that kind of risk on themselves. I think it's really great to learn from those sort of people because they can teach you a lot. And in fact, like, so one of the things that you talked about there, and I think that you and I have in common, is why we do what we do outside of those day jobs, right? Which is to share knowledge and educate. How are you approaching that with the podcast, with the Tippy Top? And who do you hope you'll be able to help? It sounds like yourself, but beyond yourself, who do you think you'll be able to help? And why is it so important that you do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, that's the litmus test. You know, would I find this advice helpful? And that's why I try when I select guests and come up with the questions and the, you know, summaries. I'm like, okay, this is really the essence of entrepreneurship that's going to move the needle. In terms of why I do it, it's the same reason. You know, when I was doing engineering at school, did engineering, graduated, came out, still didn't know anything about business. And only through, you know, a lot of education, a lot of financial education, a lot of, you know, going to business schools, running my own businesses, working in private equity. And even after that, I still didn't really understand how VC worked, or at least in the UK. So it was just incredibly inaccessible, difficult to learn, and I just don't know how anyone else would stand a chance, you know. And I think now, okay, information is a lot more ubiquitous than it was prior. But I thought, where is the, when you, you know, repository of information where you can learn? And it doesn't exist as far as I know. You know, there's a couple of books that are, you know, talk about all the unicorns, and you're like, that's great. And that does not apply to me. And as you said, like, most businesses are never going to be unicorns, and there's nothing wrong with lifestyle businesses. You know, it's, you know, that's the reality for most entrepreneurs, and that's fabulous, working for yourself. In terms of why I created the blog and now the podcast, is I just see, you know, from my slightly, you know, bird's eye view, I see entrepreneurs making the same mistakes over and over and over again, and getting fleeced by the same charlatans over and over again, and taken for a ride, and good business models, good entrepreneurs just falling down for all the wrong reasons. And, you know, if there's, you know, the number two reason for failure, according to CB Insights, no market need, okay, fine, maybe the business was never going to work. But if you're not raising the funding, or if you're running out of cash because of, you know, you don't have a good CFO or a handle on your financial model, you know, those things are criminal, really, they are. So it's, I think that's the one side of it. And the other side of it is, you know, there's this whole notion, and it's, you know, there's a big movement towards it, taking the private out of private equity. So obviously VC form, you know, falling within private equity for listeners out there. And it's saying, you know, there's a lot of people, especially in the venture community, that know more about startups than most entrepreneurs ever will. And they're hoarding all that knowledge. And you might get some of that if you take a check from them, and they might help you and plug you into their networks. But that's absolute nonsense. Surely we want all entrepreneurs to do well. Surely we want the economy to benefit. We want, you know, proper competitive markets, because that's going to give the best service to consumers. And now, more importantly, for climate tech entrepreneurs, we want to save the planet. So how are you going to do that if you're hoarding the information? So for me, it's this open source, decentralized model. Here's what I know. If you want to teach me what you know and build networks, I'm all in. If you don't, that's your bag.
I think that's incredible. I think that is wonderful. I agree that, so, and I've done a lot of kind of reading around venture venture capital. And there's some great books out there, you know, whether it's Zero to One, whether it's, you know, Venture Deals by Brad Feld, you know, Zero to One by Peter Thiel. But equally, you always get the impression that there is so much that is unsaid, maybe less so with Venture Deals. But, you know, in a lot of these books, they're great, but they tend to kind of just tell you the information that's already out there. And I think it is really valuable for entrepreneurs and, you know, investors, actually, for that matter, right? Because a lot of us now, I think, out here in the ecosystem who don't have necessarily huge liquidity, but can afford, you know, a few thousand pounds a year or whatever it might be, are starting to take small bets and small risks on investing in companies that are interesting. And I think getting inside the mindset of people that are doing this as a day job is really important. It's certainly one of the reasons that I launched this podcast, was just to get a better understanding of how venture worked and how people thought about it. So I think you're spot on there. The other thing is, I mean, thank you very much for the shout out to CFOs and financial modeling. Just for our listeners, and to be very clear, neither Alex Lee or the Development Bank of Wales are sponsoring the podcast. But no, I mean, all joking aside, I agree. Yes, I mean, product market fit is the obvious and overall reason, but many, many businesses struggle because they run out of the cash. They don't know how to fundraise. They raise the wrong amount of money. They hire too quick. They hire too slow, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's all of these nuances that I think are really important to pick up and to really, I think, you know, make well known for people that are launching their own businesses and trying to grow. I actually would really love to ask you as well, Alex, just as we wrap up, if you had one piece of advice for entrepreneurs or for founders, you know, launching or looking to raise right now, what would that be, especially given the turbulent markets that we seem to be in at the moment?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the first answer will be just do it, just start. You know, there's no perfect time and all that. And you don't need a lot of money. Like that e-commerce business, you know, wasn't turning over millions. It was probably turning over up to £25,000 per year at one point. We started it with £500 and didn't raise a cent more. All right. So you don't need a lot of money. So I think A is just get going. Whether that's a podcast, blog, business, whatever it is, start and you can polish it later. And the other thing is make sure that you test, make sure you've got a very strong value proposition. So make sure you speak to a lot of people who aren't your friends. And if you want to get some honest feedback from your friends, say, my other friend has this idea. What do you think of it? And they're more likely to tell you it's stupid rather than, yes, I'll buy it. You know, so get that value proposition. Make sure you're solving a real customer pain and not just this is a better toothbrush. It's a 9 or 10 out of 10, you know, like think about a fire. You know, if someone has a fire in their kitchen and you're like, here's a fire extinguisher, it will cost you £1,000. You're buying it every day of the week, right? Get a strong customer pain, solve that, and people will give you the money and your business will do well.
Amazing. Alex, it's been so wonderful talking to you today. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? Are you online on Twitter, on LinkedIn? Obviously, where can they find you for the tippy top? And how can they listen to more of what you have to say?
No, thanks very much. So it's all social media platforms at the Tippy Top blog, one word, LinkedIn, Alexander Lee, L-E-I-G-H, website, thetippytop.com. And you should find all links from there. And then of course, the podcast, all major podcasting platforms, the Tippy Top. I think there might be a few imposters on there, but I'm sure you'll find me.
Amazing. Alex, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful having you here.
Thanks so much, Rish. Amazing.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.